Women tend to talk about lots of personal stuff with each other. Menstruation, cramps, sex, pregnancy, breastfeeding, you name it. But there's one topic that's more hush-hush.
With menopause, if menopause walks in the room, the conversation just stops.
That's Jen Gunter. She's an OBGYN and an outspoken voice on women's health issues.
It's just amazing the cultural silence about menopause.
Jen wants to change that with her new book called The Menopause Manifesto. I'm Mikan Scott, and on this podcast extra from The Pulse, a conversation with Jen Gunter about hormones, hot flashes, diet, lifestyle, and a powerful way to reframe this time of transition in women's lives. In your book, you say that menopause essentially is puberty, but in reverse. But you also say that we tend to treat it like a precursor to death in some way. So why do we have this weird attitude toward menopause?
Well, I think it's a complicated mix of many factors. So I think that, you know, a largely patriarchal society has primarily prized women for youth and the ability to reproduce. And obviously, menopause is a sign that those two things are not there anymore. And so I think it's, you know, largely been, you know, a marker of irrelevance for women, which is incorrect. But I think that that sort of is really the basic sort of, you know, root cause, you know, if you will. So thinking about it from that standpoint.
What happens during menopause? What is going on inside of your body that kicks off this part of your life?
Well, there's a complex change in the brain-ovary connection. I think that's probably a good way to summarize it. And essentially, the eggs, or what we call oocytes, are getting to the point where there are none left that are capable of ovulating. And as this process of ovulation, monthly ovulation with the menstrual cycle, starts to wind down, that's the time that we call the menopause transition. And when the last egg has ovulated, that is, you know, that is menopause. We typically refer to menopause as starting sort of 12 months after the last period, because you don't really know it's the last period until it's the last one. So it's this process of ovulation winding down and stopping, and all of the hormonal repercussions that happen because of that.
Now, I read your chapter on hormones, and it's hard to imagine a more complicated process happening every month in our own bodies while menstruation is still going on. It seemed a bit, to me, almost like an orchestra that plays together and kicks off all these different themes and tones. And then when menopause hits, it sort of devolves into a cacophony for a bit. So what exactly is going on with your hormones during this time?
So that's an excellent description. So absolutely, hormones are exactly like, you know, an orchestral piece. Everything coming in at the right time. You know, you need high levels of certain hormones for brief periods of time, just like, you know, you might want the horn section to be loud for a brief period of time. And all together, you get this beautiful end product. And with the menopause transition, there's a little bit of chaos with that. So levels of some hormones may be higher for a period of time, or they may be lower. And all of that produces changes. So irregular periods can be the result. For some people, there can be a trigger in depression or a feeling of brain fog. Some of these things are temporary. So one example I like to use is that menopause is in many ways like a new operating system, you know, new operating system being uploaded onto a computer. And while that's happening, can sometimes be a little bit glitchy. And then once it's up and running, now you have this different program. And so some of the symptoms of the menopause transition are from that glitchy upload. So irregular periods, or perhaps brain fog, or a triggering of, you know, mild to moderate depression. Some of the things are long-lasting. So, for example, hot flushes can be quite long-lasting for some people, you know, average duration 7 years. Vaginal dryness can go on for the lifetime. And so some of these things are long-term, some of these things are short-term, but almost all of them can be managed.
I think one of the biggest topics I hear women complain about is sleep or the lack thereof. So what is going on with your hormones that causes this terrible just pattern of wakefulness or just very restless sleep?
So there's a variety of things that can contribute. And certainly I would say, you know, among the top sort of 3 to 4 concerns about menopause or, you know, medical concerns is definitely sleep. So for many people, it's hot flushes. Or hot flashes, depending on the term that you like to use. And you're being awakened by the hot flashes, so the heat wakes you up, or you're not quite waking, but you're getting to a stage of less restful sleep. So you're sort of partially awaking multiple times throughout the night. And that can have a huge impact on, you know, how deep you sleep, how long you sleep. And then also, it's important to point out that menopause is happening at a time of people's lives where often there may be other stress going on. And in addition, for some people, you know, as we age, we also develop medical conditions. So this could also be the time that something like sleep apnea is developing. So while it's important to recognize that menopause absolutely could be a contributing factor or even the cause of poor sleep, it's also important not to just say, oh, it's all hormones, and to make sure that you're looking at every contributing factor.
And that's a point you make throughout the book that, you know, menopause plays a big role, but it's not the be-all, end-all that sometimes we think it is.
Right. I like to say that there is a lot of paint on a woman's canvas, and it's not all just hormones. You know, I really kind of rail against that concept, because if you say if everything is all hormones, then that's really buying into the patriarchal concept that it is all hormones. And everything is multifactorial. And certainly menopause has been a neglected one or one treated incorrectly for a long period of time, but it's also not the only one.
How do you view the evolutionary role of menopause? We often hear this myth that, well, women were never supposed to reach menopause because we used to just die before menopause hit. But you say in the book that is not true, and you paint a different picture. So what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I heard that same myth in medical school.
Oh, really?
You know, this myth of life expectancy. Oh, yeah, that it was a very common talking point for hormones, and this idea that, you know, women all sort of dropped dead sometime in their sort of like mid to late 30s, early 40s. And, you know, what we now believe, or one of the main theories, is that, menopause is part of an important driver of evolution of the species. So grandmothers, it turns out, were very useful historically. You know, they gathered food, they helped provide shelter. It really, you know, takes a village, you know, to raise your children. And if you're thinking about, you know, living in, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago, where, you know, you have to gather food, where you're at the whim of the environment, where you might bleed after you deliver a significant amount and be too weak to gather food for yourself and for your other children. And so grandmothers, you know, provided additional support. And so there's a lot of evidence to back that up. It's called the grandmother hypothesis. There's also, you know, evidence of that in killer whale communities. Toothed whales are the only other mammals to have, you know, menopause. And when a grandmother killer whale, dies earlier than expected, her grandcalves are more likely to die earlier.
And it seems like once you start to look at menopause in a different light, it's also a beautifully orchestrated way of protecting you from having a child when your body may be not ready to have another child, or when you may be not ready to raise another child?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's really fascinating if you compare us to, you know, chimpanzees, our closest mammal relative. They stop ovulating around the same time we do. It's just they die and, you know, we keep living. And, you know, it's because living past your reproductive potential has benefit for perpetuating the species. And so for, you know, for us, you know, if you were reproducing in our 60s or 70s, you know, maternal mortality would be very high. And the worst thing for your young children is for a mother to die, right? So, you know, this is a protective mechanism. Everything is really about, you know, survival of the species.
Now, you mentioned med school a little while ago and some of the not so great information you got while there. And frankly, I've been a little bit shocked at the fact that so many doctors I've encountered in my personal life seem to know so little about hormones. So what is the state of education when it comes to hormones, especially during the menopause years?
Well, you know, I've thought a lot about this. And I think that, you know, well, first of all, there was after the Women's Health Initiative, you know, that study that really caused a lot of, I would say, trauma over hormones really led to about two generations of physicians not learning about hormone, you know, menopausal hormone therapy. So there's also that aspect. But I think the issue with how people learn in medical school is I really think they learn the information about hormones. They don't learn the practical applications and the way to explain it. I think medicine has huge communication gaps. And so we have all this knowledge, but it's not getting from A to B because we're not really often teaching doctors in the way that people need to hear something communicated. So I think that's part of it. And also, you know, medicine is a reflection of society in large. And if there's largely patriarchal thinking in society, you know what? We see that in medicine as well. You know, we see the concerns of menopausal women being dismissed as that's just aging or that's just the way it is. But, you know, there's 30 ads a week on TV for erectile dysfunction.
Yeah. Jen just brought up the Women's Health Initiative, which was a massive study that was looking into the benefits of hormone therapy. But then it seemed to find that hormone therapy led to higher rates of cancer and heart disease. Those findings turned out later to be overstated or in some cases incorrect. But when those results first came out, it created an immediate panic.
It was awful. That's really the best way to describe it. You know, I trained during my residency during what I would call, you know, the hormone heyday when it was estrogen for all my friends. You know, that was sort of the motto. And I'm not necessarily saying that's the right way to do it, but, you know, I came from a background of not being afraid of hormones, but having always explained to my patients that there was a slightly higher risk of breast cancer, but we felt that that was countered by the largely reduced risk of heart disease. That's what we believed at the time. And it was always a discussion about risks and benefits for individual patients. And then when the WHI hit, I mean, the headlines were just unbelievable and people were panicked. And you have to remember OBGYNs are among the most sued physicians. And it, you know, it was a time of sheer panic. And we, you know, people stopped hormones, we stopped them, you know, professional societies scrambled to sort of figure out the data. And, you know, undoing a terrifying headline is really hard. Even today, I have patients in the office who are suffering, and I'll say, oh, well, you know, we have this therapy, this, oh, I don't want hormones, they're too risky. And, you know, once someone has heard, you know, an incorrect piece of information repeated over and over and over again, you know, if you think it takes 3, 4, 5 points of contact to undo one incorrect piece of information, we're really rolling a big rock up a hill.
How do you talk to your patients about hormones, yes or no? What's the conversation?
Well, it depends on the patient. And so, you know, if someone's presenting with symptoms that are attributable to menopause, then, you know, we run through the list of treatments. And if hormones are in that list, which typically they are, you know, we go over the risks and the benefits, but we also discuss all the alternatives. And so, for example, if someone is having hot flushes, there are other treatments besides hormones. There is cognitive behavioral therapy. There is the medication gabapentin. There are hormones. There is the standard hormone replacement therapy, or menopausal hormone therapy, as we now call it. So the standard menopausal hormone therapy with estrogen. But sometimes we can just use doses of progesterone in higher, typically higher than we use for a menopausal hormone therapy. And so there really are a wide range of options. There are also some over-the-counter treatments, which are generally fairly ineffective, but some people want to try those because what one person finds as benefit might be different for someone else. Some people might find a 20% improvement in symptoms is sufficient, and for someone else, that's just not going to cut it.
Is there, in your opinion, a benefit to estrogen that goes beyond controlling the symptoms of menopause? Does it have some kind of protective qualities?
Well, I think that we're still trying to understand the really long-term implications of, you know, being on menopausal hormone therapy. And again, it really depends on what it's doing for you. So a woman who has no symptoms or has mild hot flushes, who isn't bothered by anything, you know, it's possible that, you know, hormones for her could have a net negative. You know, there is a small increased risk of breast cancer associated with hormones. And that the absolute long-term risks on dementia are still not completely clarified. So certainly for women starting over the age of 60, hormones would not be recommended. That does seem to be associated with an increased risk in cardiac disease and in dementia. But there, it does appear to be a window under the age of 60 or within 10 years from the final menstrual period where hormones may, for many women, have a net benefit. But again, it all depends on what are your symptoms, what else is going on with your lifestyle or with your life or your medical conditions. And I always get back to the fact that the three healthiest things a woman can do for her menopause transition and beyond are quitting smoking, getting the recommended exercise, and eating a healthy, balanced diet.
And should progesterone be part of MHT, or what's the role of that?
If a woman has a uterus, then absolutely she needs what's called a progestogen, which is either progesterone or a progesterone-like hormone called a progestin. We believe that progesterone has the lowest risk of breast cancer associated with it. The risk is small. The decrease is small, but it's definite. So we think that that is the lowest risk and the preferable starting therapy. But that doesn't mean the others are high risk, right? So it's all, everything's on a continuum. Progesterone is needed, or progestin, because estrogen will stimulate the lining of the uterus. And over time, that can cause cancer of the lining of the uterus. So for women with a uterus, they need an estrogen for menopausal hormone therapy plus a progestogen. Women who don't have a uterus do not need the progestogen. The only point there is for treatment of or prevention of cancer of the lining of the uterus. But, you know, in menopause, there's almost always an exception because progesterone can also help people sleep.
Yes.
So for some, yeah, I know, it's always with the exceptions in menopause. So for a woman who's having trouble sleeping from hot flushes, progesterone at night might be the therapy for her.
Yeah. and I'm also hearing from a lot of women who say the mood issues are massive. So I've heard from women who have tried to stop, you know, their medication or their hormones, and they said their irritability is just out of control.
Well, it's always hard to know. Certainly, you know, during the menopause transition, you know, this time of really complete hormonal chaos, that, you know, for many women, you know, having more regular control or less fluctuation in their hormones can be very beneficial mood-wise. Some women get PMS type symptoms, right? You know, with their period, and those can be heightened during the menopause transition because some cycles your estrogen level can actually be much higher than typical. And sometimes it's lower. And so it's these wild swings back and forth that can make people feel unwell. But they don't make everybody feel unwell. Some people don't notice any mood changes. So it's really different person to person. After you've sort of gone through that time of the menopause transition, it is possible that stopping estrogen could make some people feel worse. It's also possible it could be a nocebo effect, meaning that you stop it and you're sort of expecting to feel worse, and it's sort of like a reverse placebo effect. And so it's just important to, you know, really sort of sort things out and to be very, I would say, stepwise about it. You know, if a woman's on menopausal hormone therapy for 5 years and she says, listen, I want to stop it. I'm 52 now. I want to see if I still need it. You know, you want to give your body a little bit of time to adjust to stopping it.
Yeah. When is a good time to stop? Or how do you have that conversation?
So we don't have the greatest long-term data on, you know, sort of 20 years, 15 years. So we're still trying to figure some of that out. So I think it always gets back to, you know, what are the hormones doing for you? And what they're doing for me may be very different than what they're doing for everybody else. So from my standpoint, I'm on menopausal hormone therapy. I have a very strong history of osteoporosis. My mother died from complications related to osteoporosis. The last 20 years of her life were dominated by pain, disability, and complications related to osteoporosis. So for me, preventing that is paramount. And estrogen is preventative for osteoporosis. It helps reduce the risk. So for me, that's very different. I might feel very differently about hormones than someone who has no family history of osteoporosis, you know, whose mother was running marathons in their 80s, you know. So you have to look at what it's doing for you. I also have really bad hot flushes, even now, you know, 3 to 4 years after menopause. It looks like I'm in the super flusher category. And, you know, my partner, who I love dearly, jokes that sometimes the heat from my body wakes him up in the middle of the night. And he thinks, boy, I could cook a pizza on you.
So you could potentially stay on hormones for quite some time.
Yeah. I mean, so for me, someone with no family history of breast cancer, not anyone, not one family member on either side of the family, who has an incredibly strong family history of osteoporosis. So for me, there may be a net benefit, but as more data emerges, you know, I might change. So for example, if we found out something after 20 years of use of hormones that we didn't know before, that might change my mind. And so it's always important to reevaluate, you know, what the hormones are actually doing for you and to decide if it's worth continuing for you. And that's that's part of, you know, individualizing therapy.
Now, I'm personally just getting absolutely bombarded with ads for different products that will solve all of my problems. But there is this exploding market of different gummies and products that will take care of all of your potentially menopause-related issues. How do we evaluate those? What are some questions we should ask?
Well, if something sounds too good to be true, it is.
Very sad, yes.
That is the truth. And many of these companies, like, you know, we humans love heuristics. We all want something boiled down to a simple fix. We're all like that. And, you know, the companies that make these products are well aware of that. They're playing on emotions. And if there was a simple supplement that took care of all of the menopausal symptoms, we'd be prescribing it. We'd be recommending it. And you know what? Big Pharma would probably have figured that out and they'd be monetizing it, right? So, you know, many, many, many of these herbal and botanical and other supplements have been tested and they've either been dismal or the quality of the studies is so poor, it's not possible to draw a conclusion. And it's also important to remember that many of these sort of special supplements, I'll call them menaceuticals. I'm not talking about, for example, taking vitamin D if you need it, or taking iron if you have iron deficiency, but these sort of, you know, combination products or things that claim to support your ovaries or support your menopause. It's just all marketing. And there is a rapidly increasing percentage of people developing liver failure from supplements. You know, many of these supplements don't contain what they claim. For example, this is a big problem with black cohosh, a supplement that's frequently an herbal supplement, frequently promoted for hot flushes. First of all, the data doesn't really show that it works, so there's that. But a significant percentage of black cohosh supplements don't contain black cohosh. They can contain a completely different plant that isn't even found in North America. Black cohosh is supposed to be from North America.
And you also say in the book to stay away from sort of over-the-counter hormone products, right? The stuff I could order on Amazon and such.
Oh, absolutely. You have no idea what's in those, first of all, because with supplements, you know, there's essentially no regulation. And these products could be adulterated with hormones. If you're getting estrogen and you don't know it, that could be putting you at risk for cancer of the lining of the uterus, or depending on the dose, breast cancer or other complications, blood clots. You know, maybe they contain birth control pills. I mean, who knows, right? So I think that, you know, a hormone should be a pharmaceutical, because then you know what you're prescribing. You know how it's absorbed in the body. You can predict the results.
There are a few supplements that may be helpful. You mentioned vitamin D. What else?
Yeah, so vitamin D is made by our skin. We get a very little bit from food. And depending on your sun avoidance, right, depending on how much sunscreen you use, if you wear hats, if you cover up for other reasons, and with age, your ability to make vitamin D goes down. And vitamin D is very important because it helps you absorb calcium, and it may also have some other impact on the bone. So over the age of 50, for many people, it's reasonable to take a vitamin D supplement. If you're not getting the recommended calcium in your diet, so if you're not getting the 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day that you need, then a calcium supplement will also be useful. So it's not that you're taking above and beyond the calcium you need, you're just making sure you're getting what you need. If you can't get it from your diet, you can get it from your supplements. And so you should look at each sort of individual micronutrient per se. But calcium and vitamin D are sort of the two big ones that are really important, because if you don't have enough calcium in your diet, your body will draw from your bones as a reservoir. And as your risk of osteoporosis increases with age, that's not a good thing.
I want to talk about some of the lifestyle measures that you mention in the book, and nutrition is a big one. And for lots of women, as we get older, maintaining a healthy weight can become just a horrible struggle, yeah. To say the least.
I feel you.
Yeah. I mean, it can be all consuming. So what should women pay attention to?
Well, I think, you know, I like to tell people to focus on, health and what's the best for your health. Certainly, you know, I grew up in the 80s and the 90s, which I think is sort of a uniquely horrible time for body image, although I suspect every era is uniquely horrible in a different way.
Yes. I don't think it has gotten much better.
Yeah, I think it's just a different type. Is it just different decades or different types of awful? Maybe that's the best way to put it. So, you know, focusing on the building blocks of a healthy diet. So making sure that you have enough fiber. Fiber does so many things for the body. It, you know, reduces your risk of colon cancer. It keeps you regular. Everybody feels better when they're regular. Reduces your risk of hemorrhoids. Nobody likes hemorrhoids. You know, so these this is a very important, you know, building block. Fiber also makes you feel more full with your meals. So for someone who maybe has concerns about weight gain, making sure that you're having enough fiber in your diet is a really good strategy. And you need about 25 grams a day. And the nice thing about focusing on fiber is it's adding something in. It's not taking something away. right? So it's, it's a positive to focus on as opposed to a negative, because we already receive enough negative messaging.
Food can get a little bit confusing because we hear about hormones in foods that are either naturally phytohormones or then hormones in foods that were added, like in milk or meat. So that can get really confusing really fast.
Yes, it can. And that's why I devoted several chapters to that. You know, so phytoestrogens are not hormones. There are substances that can act like hormones, and they can act like a weak estrogen on some tissues. There's been a lot of research looking at phytoestrogens, and they don't really seem to help hot flushes at all. They don't seem to have an impact. If they do, it's a very minor, but they're also not negative, right? And there are some diets that are incredibly high in phytoestrogens, for example, a traditional Japanese diet. And there's also some diets that are incredibly low in phytoestrogens, like the Mediterranean diet. But people can live in both those areas of the world and have incredible longevity and be incredibly healthy. And you know, that's because their diet also is, you know, high in vegetables and low in saturated fat and high in fatty fish, high in these things and high in fiber. So high in these things that are beneficial. So if you like phytoestrogens and you like foods that have them, that's great. And if you don't, that's okay too. So I think that's, you know, that's kind of the summary of sort of phytoestrogens. Whereas hormones in food, there doesn't really seem to be the impact that we think. You know, the thing that I remind people is that hormones are actually not absorbed well from your intestine. That's because that's not how we were sort of evolved to get them. We didn't evolve to get hormones from our diet. We evolved to get them from ovaries and our adrenal glands. So it's an internal job. So to absorb, you know, hormones orally requires really sort of massive doses. And that's just not simply what we're exposed to, you know, in our foods. So there may be, you know, other, you know, downstream effects and other things. But for women in menopause or in their menopause transition, I would just say, you know, focus on a healthy, balanced diet and what you like, and try to focus on vegetables, lots of vegetables, you know, cutting back on saturated fats. And certainly if you're not eating fatty fish a couple of times a week, like salmon or tuna or other types of fatty fish, then an omega-3 supplement, you know, might be something that can also be helpful for your heart.
As we age, we lose muscle mass, which affects our metabolism and our strength. So Jen says exercise is key.
So, you know, focusing on, you know, keeping active and doing your, you know, the amount of activity that we need. And certainly, you know, during this past year, I, you know, there were some days that maybe I walked 800 steps. You know, I didn't leave the house. I, you know, tried to limit going to the grocery store, as we all did right at the beginning of the pandemic. We didn't know what was going on. And so, you know, I think for many people, this past year has, you know, for me, I feel it's had a really big impact on my muscles. So I'm really looking at ways to be more physically active.
And I like something you say in the book, which is that exercise is like free money. So even when you're getting a little bit, it's still great.
Yeah, you know, I think many of us have this binary thinking about the things we do for our health. We either have to do it exactly in the right amount or it's useless, right? It's this good or bad binary. And that's not helpful. You know, exercise really is money in the bank. It builds bones. It's good for your heart. It's good for your muscles. You know, building more muscle is good for your metabolism. It helps prevent falls. You know, there are so many ways it can be helpful for people, you know, who have mood issues. And so, you know, exercise is like free money. And so, you know, any little bit that you do is better than none.
How do you hope women might reframe their thinking on menopause as a time in our lives, you know, getting away from this narrative that it's just one step away from death, basically?
Right. Well, I would say that think back to when you went through puberty, there may have been a couple of years where you did not quite feel yourself. Your brain was changing. Your body was changing. You know, you may have even developed some things that you didn't want to have, like, for example, acne. But nobody goes back and says, wow, you know, puberty transformed me into this, or I would say mostly nobody. There's always probably somebody. We don't go back and look at being a child, the time before puberty, as being the gold standard. You know, these are phases in life that are part of life. And, you know, the menopause is just another phase. And it's not bad or good. There's nothing binary about it. It's just another phase. It's just another step in the journey. And a patriarchal society has dominated the script of menopause until recently. And we need to reject that script. We need to rip it up. I mean, it's a sign of strength. It's a sign of perseverance. It's a sign of still being vital in contributing. It's a sign of still being relevant. And so, you know, your worth to society has nothing to do with ovaries, has nothing to do with estrogen. And I guess that's how I'm hoping to reframe it. And also giving women the tools to manage the symptoms so they can continue to be as vital and as amazing as I know they are.
Jen Gunter is an OBGYN. Her new book is called The Menopause Manifesto. You can subscribe to The Pulse wherever you get your podcasts and get a new episode each week. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.